You're listening to Front Page Sunday from WKMS News. I'm Chad Lampe.
And I'm Todd Hatton. A change to the way Marshall County students are graded means no more Fs, but it also means no more straight As. The Marshall County School System this year began a plan to eliminate letter grades at all six of its elementary schools. The district has joined others across the Commonwealth implementing what's called a standards-based grading system, in which teachers measure learning based on skill sets. The first school in the district to make the change is Central Elementary, with the other five coming on board next year. Marshall County Schools Elementary Instruction Supervisor Abby Griffey joins Angela Hatton to talk about why her district is making the switch.
From what I understand, the comprehensive designations for the standards-based system are exceeds mastery, mastery, partial mastery, or non-mastery. What exactly does the standards-based system look at?
It looks actually at particular standards that are given to us by the Common Core. It's more specific to what the child actually has mastered as far as their learning and things that they might be having trouble with. I'll give you, for instance, say a child is in math on a traditional report card for math for the 9 weeks or the 6 weeks when you bring it home. You know, you'd get the traditional letter grade, a B. Say the child brings home a C for whatever. I mean, really, what does a parent know about that child? They would probably think that they're just an average math student. When they get a standards-based report card home, math is broken up by the concepts that were actually taught that 9 weeks. So say they went over multiplication, they might have covered division that 9 weeks, they may have even covered fractions in a 9 weeks period. That parent would actually know whether the child mastered the multiplication, say two-digit multiplication, whether they mastered, you know, division as well, and maybe they have a partial mastery on fractions. So it is much more information that a parent's getting instead of just, in math, my child got a C. He's an average math student. And there is a lot of things that go into a traditional grade that we've taken out by using this standards-based method. In a typical type grade, there's a lot of non-academic factors that could go in a traditional type grade, such as attitude of a child, responsibility, respect the child has, work habits, and things like that. We do think those are important to teach, but we were in a standards-based system, you report those out separately. They don't actually affect the academic or knowledge grade that a child's receiving over a standard.
So what's a report card going to look like then?
Right now, it is basically we've taken the standards and we've put those English and language arts and math standards and from the Common Core, and we've reworded those in type of parent-friendly terms for ICANN statements, but not only for the parent, for the student to be able to explain the report card to the parent. Specifically, you know, I can write a poem. I can, write a story using dialogue. It'll be specific to the standards. It'll probably be a page to two pages long, but not everything will be indicated. Just whatever that 9 weeks, it'll be reported out. And teachers will make comments particular to the child's learning.
So how does this affect a teacher's daily workload and how they approach teaching each individual student?
I wished you could talk to a teacher about that, but I will tell you, I've met with them several times, and they were here yesterday, and we were talking. They have completely had to rethink what they're doing in the classroom. They have rewritten the majority of their assessments that they use. They have had to rethink what the purpose of homework is for. They're using more formative assessments, daily assessments in the classroom to determine whether or not a child knows the objective for the day, whatever that target was for the learning that day. They do an assessment that day in class. They could be a quiz or anything, and it doesn't necessarily count for a grade. It is really so the teacher knows if the child knows.
What happens if at the end of the school year there's a student who may have mastered 3 out of 4 skill sets or areas, but that fourth one they've just been trying all year and it just hasn't worked? Do you then move that on to the next year, or do you backtrack?
That's where teachers will use their professional, you know, training that they've had, and they will actually go in and discuss individual students and discuss, you know, the next year it could be that in order to retain a student, it would have to be that we would think that it is going to be in that student's, you know, very best interest. There would have to be lots of things that they did not master in order to retain, because the next year that could be a skill that next year with reteaching and things that they can go on. I'm not saying that every child under this system masters everything. We try to get them to mastery and we give them more chances. But of course, it's very typical for us to send through a traditional grading system. If we were continued to do that, you know, definitely we send kids on that have D's. You know, you can have straight D's, and it's not an F, and we send you on. It's definitely better than our old system, because we may have partial mastery, but if we do send them on, we can definitely have conversations with that next grade level teacher.
And eventually you're going to be putting this into place for all of your elementary schools. If it's an effective way to grade students and an effective way to evaluate students, is there any chance that you're going to be moving this up to the middle grades, to high school as well?
Well, actually, I can't comment on that. I think our charge right now is to get it implemented into the elementary schools. That's our focus, and to get it done correctly.
It's kind of interesting, I think, that Kentucky has no regulation or law mandating what kind of grading system schools can use. It's totally up to local discretion.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, it makes me wonder, why aren't more school districts doing this? You know, there are a handful who are putting it into place, but not everybody is doing it.
I think you will probably see more going in that direction. I just know from the buzz about it now with what's going on in Marshall County, we've gotten several school districts in the state have contacted us for information. I was a middle school teacher, so I had the traditional mindset. And it took me lots of time hearing about standards-based grading, the theory behind it, before I was sold on the whole process of it. But once you change that mindset and you educate teachers on why this is good for kids, and that's huge in itself, just educating teachers to change a habit and a belief that we've had for so long, that traditional grading, you know, if it's not broke, don't fix it. We all had that mindset, but we had never actually put grading under a microscope to look at it. So not a teacher's fault or anybody, but I think it's just come into light that we really need to focus on what grading, you know, why are we grading? What's the purpose of a grade?
One thing I'm wondering about is how students are feeling about this, because I've read one argument for standards-based grading is that the traditional letter-based grading has a stigma attached to it. For example, I'm thinking, you know, a student gets all A's except for one class, let's say math, which is a problem for a lot of students, that he or she gets a D in that class, and then the student will think, oh, I'm stupid because I got a D in math. Are you worried that this might carry over to the new system? They see a lot of non-mastery or partial mastery, and they'll think, oh, well, I'm stupid. I don't get that. How are you working on that issue?
I think it allows for us to do interventions much quicker than we would have done them. Let's just take, for instance, a traditional classroom. I use myself, because as a middle school teacher, we would take notes. We might have a quiz, you know, at the end of the week on Friday, and our unit might last 3 weeks to get that done. And I would take some grades. I'd take some homework grades along the way. But I don't think I ever specifically looked and thought, oh, goodness, you know, this child didn't do well. I need to go to him today and fix that and work with that child. As far as the student's chance, they're going to have multiple opportunities to show that they master something, and that's different than in the past. You know, they took one summative exam, and that was it, and that's your grade, and we're moving on. Either you didn't get it or you got it. That is not the mindset now. And like I said, we may not catch everybody to mastery, but we definitely will catch more this way than we were in the past.
Abby Griffey, Marshall County Schools Elementary Instruction Supervisor, thank you for talking with me.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Now, I don't claim to be an A student, but I'm trying to be, for maybe by being an A student, baby, I can win your love for me. Don't know much about history, don't know much biology, don't know much about a science book, don't know much about the French I took. But I do know that I love you, and I know that if you love me too, for the one.
would be.
La ta 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 ta.
History.
The 25th annual Intertribal Powwow wraps up today at the Trail of Tears Commemorative Park in Hopkinsville. The park was home to Cherokee Indians for a short time in the 1830s when they made their trek from their ancestral homes to Oklahoma. The powwow features music, storytelling, and Native American dancing. I spoke with Powwow Chairman Roger Ritchie earlier this week as he was setting up for the events. What's unique about this powwow? It is the 25th anniversary.
There's nothing that's going to be really unique other than we're going to have some different ceremonies from our mayor, and we're going to have some things that I can't tell anyone about on Saturday and Sunday. It's going to be very special. We're going to have numerous fancy dancers this year. We're going to have a hoop dancer this year. We have really just made leaps and bounds with our park.
The city's been doing quite a bit of work on the park. What's been happening with the park?
They built us a new park in a different area. We had flood problems for so many years in the other park that they moved us in a higher ground. They put new electrical facilities all around. They gave us water. They put big arena lights around. They've just made so many improvements. It's just a beautiful, beautiful sight now.
Now, is this far away from the actual location where the Cherokee Indians had bedded down during the wintertime?
It's not real far away, and honestly, when they had come through this area, they actually camped for several months on about 45 acres here. And so there was thousands of Cherokee in this area, and the park was just one area that they were at. Actually, where one of our shopping centers is now, they camped there for several months.
Let's talk about the dance competition, which are draws for many, many people who come to the Intertribal Powwow. The dancers dress in these traditional outfits. Can you explain more about the message that these different types of dances and outfits may send to those watching?
Cherokee call them regalia, and their regalia is very sacred. As a matter of fact, this dance competition this weekend is actually very spiritual. This is a gathering place to represent the people that passed on in this on these grounds, and everything that they wear has a meaning. Every little bead, every little feather, every piece of leather that they have. Their shoes are all made. I mean, everything they make, they are just fascinating to see. And the more important that the people were in the tribe, the more things that they had to represent their authority. And it's just fascinating to see these beautiful, beautiful things, this regalia that they produce.
I tried to specifically say outfits because in reading before this interview, I found some do's and don'ts that you're supposed to avoid while watching the dancing. And one of the don'ts is to not call the regalia a costume because it's not a costume. What are some of the other don'ts that people should be aware of when they go to this sacred ceremony?
One of the big ones is everybody likes to photograph these people. Well, you need to be respectful of that because you need to get their permission before that because this is a spiritual moment. This is time when they are representing the spirits and the gods of their past. And so they're very particular about being photographed. They are okay with it, but you need to ask their permission before you do that.
And how many dancers do you expect to have this year?
We're approximately about 300.
It sounds like a big time at the Intertribal Powwow there at the Trail of Tears Commemorative Park in Hopkinsville. This is the 25th anniversary, and we hope that if you're in the region, you can go and see this powwow. Roger Ritchie, you are the powwow chairman. Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate your time.
The powwow wraps up today with events starting at 1 o'clock at the Trail of Tears Commemorative Park in Hopkinsville. You can see more at WKMS.org.
The hard-headed college or high school athlete takes on the field today could mean neurological problems in their future. We'll look at the risks with an area physician who works with young people who suffer sports-related concussions when Front Page Sunday from WKMS News returns.
As a WKMS listener, you probably understand our funding model. In autumn and spring, you're asked to chip in your share of what it takes to keep WKMS going. Your pledge now online shortens this process, and your name goes in the hat for the Kindle Fire giveaway when you contact WKMS by September 19th, with or without commitment. Sound good to you?
You're listening to Front Page Sunday from WKMS News. I'm Todd Hatton.
And I'm Chad Lampe. Over the past few years, we've seen a number of reports from the National Football League, the National Hockey League, and other professional sports organizations about the tragic consequences that come from a lifetime of hard hits and the effects of the concussions that come with them. There's been speculation that several high-profile athlete suicides were related to what health professionals call post-concussion syndrome. Now, there's growing concern that the hits young athletes suffer in high school and college sports could have the same effects later in life. Dr. Chris King is a neurologist with West Kentucky Neurology in Murray, and Shelley Baskin spoke with him about the dangers and effects of concussions on young athletes.
Obviously, getting hit in the head, getting a concussion isn't going to be good for anybody, but I would assume that it's going to be particularly bad for young people whose brains are still developing. What's in place to protect them? Do you know of any state laws, rules and that sort of thing for players and coaches at the youth levels?
Yeah, so it's a good question, and I think that it's a trickle-down effect. You know, everybody knows about the NFL now and the rules that they've put in place. And you'll have to check this, but I believe there was a House bill that was signed by Governor Beshear in April of 2012 that outlines some basic things that need to happen as far as sports-related injuries. I think it requires that coaches and parents be informed and trained to some degree. It requires that kids that have suffered a concussion be pulled out of games, and it requires that that when they go back into a game, they're cleared by a physician or medical personnel. And so those are things that are starting to be put in place. Now, they're kind of it's kind of an umbrella. You know, it's a general coverage, but it in no way really gets to the heart of the matter, which is the difficult questions. When the coach is on the sideline and he has a kid that's been hit, you know, how should he or she evaluate that child, and how long should they keep them out? When should they send them back in? These are all things that are still debated and topics of conversation among physicians. And there's a lot of scales that we use. There's about 20 of them, frankly. They sort of outline what are the standards of care as far as sending kids back in.
And speaking of standards of care, is this something that people in your field and other physicians are getting more involved with local teams, or the local teams are trying to bring them in more so that they have a better awareness of what to be looking for when a kid gets hit on the field?
Absolutely. I mean, now that it's become a national issue, and frankly, now that there are lawsuits, you know, it's taken on a life of its own now, and it's grown into something very big. And so every school now, I think, has a vested interest in making sure that this is handled the right way. And it can be a simple process, really, as long as you have the checks and balances in place to clear athletes to replay or not play again. You know, people like Richard Blaylock, who is the physician for the college, you know, does an incredible job of evaluating these guys and women on the sideline and deciding, you know, they can't go back in, or they need to go back in. And, you know, he'll call me sometimes and say, hey, I got a kid here I'm really worried about. Can you take a look at him? And, you know, we try to get him in that day or the next day and say, what's going on here? And so, yeah, I mean, we're becoming more and more involved. I get a lot of kids from the coaches call, and they say, I need you to take a look at this kid. We don't want to play him until you've had a chance to look at him or her. I keep saying him, but actually females are even more at risk.
Yeah, and that was one of the things that, from the latest numbers that I've been seeing, is a huge number of female athletes that are coming in with these injuries, soccer, lacrosse, that sort of thing. What has caused this increase? I mean, I'm sure there's multiple factors, but what's going on there?
This is a very hot topic right now in research, and it's frankly not very well understood. It's thought that there are multiple factors involved here, and I'll just outline a few of them. First of all, just to give you a fact, I think the average speed, when a soccer player heads a ball, it's thought that it's going about 70 miles an hour. The impact is the equivalent of that. So it is a major problem. And I remember playing soccer, and we didn't even think about it, you know. And now, and then you also have more and more women getting involved in sports, to the point now where I think it's 50-50 now. And there are a lot of women soccer players. So this is a major problem. And actually, that's the area where most women in organized sports are hurt, is soccer. Men, it's football. Women, it's soccer. So we don't understand why women are more prone to these injuries, but it's very, very clear that they are. The statistics are overwhelming that when a woman suffers a concussion, they are usually affected more by it, and the effect of it is more prolonged. Now, without getting too much on the biochemical level, there are definitely differences between a male brain and a female brain, especially when you're dealing with hormones. And the interesting thing about it is that there's some discussion that the female hormones might be neuroprotective, and they might actually help a brain recover more. So that doesn't really fit in with the whole picture, why women are more affected than men. We just don't know. But we know that it's clearly the case, clearly the case.
I know that from what I was reading, recovery times for like high school athletes could be three times as long as someone for college. But just from my experience, when I was in high school sports, people weren't taking off a long time after these injuries. Is this a big problem?
Sure, and again, this is where things are changing. Again, when I was younger, you know, it was not uncommon to get hit hard and then go back out on the field, and to some degree that still happens, but I think as awareness is grown about this issue, people are realizing that the effects of a concussion can last for a long time. There are, like I said, there are rating scales. There are different they're trying to basically, there's an attempt to sort of establish a standard of care. I tend to use the American Academy of Neurology as my, you know, sort of standard as far as what needs to happen. But you can take a look at those scoring scales. I mean, they all, basically concussions are rated from, mild to severe, or grade zero, grade one, grade two, grade three. And the more severe a head injury, and generally one way you can gauge that is how long someone's knocked out. Now, most kids aren't knocked out. Most kids don't lose consciousness. Clearly, if they lose consciousness, generally for less than a minute, for more than a minute, it's a very big deal. And that's where you get into life-threatening type injuries, and you certainly would not want to play them for a long time. Some of those can even be career-ending. Mm-hmm. I'm extremely conservative when it comes to this stuff. I have children, and I would want their doctor to be very conservative. So as far as, you know, when I evaluate a child, I go above and beyond the standard of care as far as really what needs to happen. And a lot of that's a clinical judgment, you know, just how do they look? How do they feel? How are their symptoms? But generally they need to be symptom-free for a certain amount of time before they can go back. And generally I like them to ease back into practice. They need to be symptom-free during practice for a week or two, and then they can ease back into the game itself.
Dr. Chris King is a neurologist with West Kentucky Neurology in Murray. He works with youth and young adults suffering from sport-related concussions.
Earlier this year, the Kentucky Journalism Hall of Fame inducted three West Kentuckians to the ranks of other great journalists of the Commonwealth: D.J. Everett of WKDZ, WHVO Radio in Cadiz, Murray State University Professor Emeritus Dr. Robert McGahee, and Chip Hutchison of the Times Leader and Eagle Post. Today we continue our series of conversations with these gentlemen. For Chip Hutchison, journalism is a family business. His parents bought what was then the Princeton Leader when he was 10 months old, and he grew up helping in the newspaper offices. Hutchison was sports editor for the Kentucky New Era for 6 years until 1976, when he took over as Princeton Leader publisher. Following a 1992 buyout, the paper became the Times Leader. Today, Hutchison serves on the New Era board and is publisher of the Eagle Post, and he still writes a weekly column called Chips Off the Old Block. Now, Hutchison sits down to speak with Angela Hatton.
You've joked that you have ink in your veins. So I'm wondering, how far back exactly does your family's newspaper business go?
Well, actually, there was no one in the newspaper business until my father, who, when he was at the University of Kentucky, began to pursue that as a career, got interrupted, of course, by World War II when served in the Army, and then once that obligation was finished after the war, why he returned to UK, worked at the Lexington, at that time the Lexington Leader, and also worked on the UK student newspaper, the Kentucky Colonel. And my father then pursued that as his career, was editor of the Pineville Sun. When he and my wife and my mother moved to Princeton, they did not know a soul in Princeton, but that newspaper became available. They knew the owner through my mother's family. Actually, the owner of that paper had been in the wedding of my maternal grandparents. So they knew that newspaper was for sale. They bought that in 1949, and when I was just, of course, an infant. And they moved to Princeton not knowing a soul, but that became home from then on.
You yourself got involved really early in your father's business, and apparently that became a passion for you. I understand you started writing sports articles at a young age?
Start writing sports when I was around probably eighth, ninth grade, was writing sports articles. And from Little League baseball games to then, of course, Caldwell County high school football games.
Do you remember what maybe your first published article was and what that experience was like?
I don't remember the specific one, but I would say it was probably a Little League baseball game because there was not much you could do wrong in those types of things. And I enjoyed that. Football was a little bit more challenging just because there was so much more interest in it. And being young, I did not want to look foolish, did not want to look like I didn't know what I was doing and talking about. But it was always a love for me. And it is a challenge. Mm-hmm. It's a challenge with deadlines, and to when you understand the public's expectation for a quality product, and your mistakes are there for everyone to see. You know, they're not, in our minds, they're not forgotten. That somebody can always go back to that printed page and they see, boy, you really messed that up.
Yeah.
So it's a challenge.
Print is forever, so to speak. Yeah.
Yes, it is.
But you actually left the family business for a short period between 1970 and 76, working for the New Era. Mm-hmm. So how did that come about? Why not just go and be a sports editor at the Princeton Leader? Why go to the Kentucky New Era?
That's a very interesting story, because I graduated from UK in 1970 and was one of these, as I guess many people are, when you get a college degree, you think you know everything. And I thought I knew everything. And I guess my world got shaken when we had the lottery in 1970, but it wasn't the lottery that has a Powerball. It was a lottery that gave you 2 years with Uncle Sam, free room and board. And I had a low lottery number, so I was going to be drafted. And so as I got out of school, I figured, well, in 2 or 3 months, I'm probably going to be going into the Army. And I had a classmate, Mike Herndon, who was from Hopkinsville, and Mike just pleaded with me, come and talk to the New Era. They need a sports editor. So I did, and they were willing to hire me, even though they knew I would probably be gone before very long. And I went back to my dad and said, well, they've offered me a job, but, you know, I don't think I'm going to take that. And he said, I would encourage you to do that. He said, you will learn more working for someone else than you will for me. He had my best interest at heart. And he knew that with working with family is so much rather than working for somebody else who is not family, and they really can hold you accountable. Because a parent will allow a child to get away with things that other people will not typically.
What's a tough position to take in sports? For Christian County, I guess.
Right. Well, at that time, you know, you had programs. You had a Hopkinsville program in football that was just one of the best programs in the state. You had a Christian County program that was suffering. You had the personalities that were involved, and is a school system, is it totally supportive of both programs? And are there, you know, what makes one program different from another? And nobody likes to be label the loser in a community, but to tackle some of those issues about what's it going to take. And of course, sports in that era was so different from today, because today we have, particularly in the collegiate and professional, you've got court cases and eligibility issues, and NCAA is, you know, what we saw with the Penn State. You didn't have those situations back 42 years ago. It was pretty much a sports editor report on the games, and that was it. Mm. And they pushed me to do the more behind the scenes, get the real story, rather than just taking a coach saying, well, we're going to play such and such team, and they're a really good football team. You know, there's more to a sports story than just quoting the cliches.
Yeah.
And they were great at pushing me, at challenging me to not just do enough to just get by, but to make it a story that people really want to see and to personalize it.
I want to take some time to ask you a little bit about the Times Leader, because one thing I noted about it, it was the first weekly paper to have an online presence.
Right. That is correct.
And I've seen more and more print operations going toward online content. I remember reading recently that the Times-Picayune in New Orleans has now gone 3 days a week and doing a lot more online content rather than printing. So how do you see that this evolution moving from print copy to online copy, how do you think that's affecting particularly rural journalism in our region?
Angela, that's an excellent question. And the issue of print, a printed product versus an online product, is something that nobody has an answer for right now. Every newspaper struggling is, what is the mixture? What is the balance? To me, I think that Warren Buffett, who is a billionaire investor we all know of, chairman of Berkshire Hathaway, that company just bought 26 daily newspapers a few months ago. And he came out with some pretty strong statements that he thinks that the printed product is here to stay, but only if you do not give your product away online. And so that's what newspapers are struggling with, is do you have a strong local content? And that is much more difficult in the metropolitan areas, New Orleans and other places, because you have so much competition between, you know, TV stations, radio stations, and even online ventures. But he's very adamant in that a newspaper that is strongly rooted in its community, whose focus is on the local product, that it can succeed, but it cannot succeed if it just replicates its printed product online. So it needs to either have a paid site, some kind of pay feature on it, a paywall. We see all the Gannett papers. Courier Journal is moving that direction with what's called a metered approach. I think there is opportunity online. It's just very difficult today. Newspapers have really not figured out a way to make a lot of money online.
Yeah.
In other words, and I don't mean that from necessarily a profit standpoint, but how do you make enough money to keep all your reporters, to keep your news gathering operation going, if you cannot make much money off if you can't bring much money in off the website?
Thank you very much, Chip Hutchison, for coming in and speaking with us today. And congratulations on your recent induction into the Kentucky Journalism Hall of Fame.
Thank you so much. I enjoyed talking with you.
When we come back, we'll get a peek behind the scenes of the inaugural production from the Paris Players and hear from the regional historian and author who is the keynote speaker at this year's Murray State University History Department Hammock Scholarship Banquet. This is Front Page Sunday from WKMS News.
Are you confused about how WKMS asks you for financial assistance? Gift, donation, membership, contribution, pledge, what is it? No matter what you call it, see how it works at WKMS.org. While you're there, read up on the Kindle Fire giveaway on September 19th, and lest we forget, click Pledge Now and see how easy it is to help the station you love. Thanks.
You're listening to Front Page Sunday from WKMS News. I'm Todd Hatton.
And I'm Chad Lampe. Thornton Wilder's play Our Town examines typical American life in the early 1900s. Set in the Anytown, USA of Grover's Corner, New Hampshire, Our Town divides the characters' lives up into three acts marked by major life events, emphasizing the eternal beauty of mundane everyday events. For their inaugural production, the Paris Players are presenting this classic today at the Kreider Performing Arts Center in Paris, and Rose Kristen Presson sat down to talk about it with Paris Henry County Arts Council Director Mike Murphy, who produced the show and plays the character of George Gibbs.
Did you personally learn anything or have any revelations during this entire production?
I'm personally having a background in acting, and I'm an acting instructor, and I teach all the time about ad-libbing and pantomime and all of the things, you know, don't let your surroundings, don't let your set be your whole bag of tricks. It's all about what's inside in your character. And this play, why I don't consider it really necessarily a traditional piece of theater, because the fourth wall is broken and there's no set. There are very few props. I mean, really, I had to put my money where my mouth is. You know, a lot of my students are either in it or are coming to see it. And, you know, you have to pantomime. If there's a doorknob, you have to pantomime that doorknob. If you're picking up a cup of coffee or holding a pencil, nothing's there. So I think the main thing I learned is that you can't rely on things when you're on stage. You have to rely on your character and what's inside.
This play has some pretty heavy themes, I think.
Yeah.
What do you think the audience is going to feel like walking out of the theater?
It deals with everyday life. The first act is called the Daily Life. The second act is called Love and Marriage. And the third act is never titled, but it's about death. And so the audience in the third act sees death. They get to see kind of the inside of these dead people's brains, you know, and see what they were thinking. And it is somewhat grim of a third act, you know, but it ends with the narrator coming back out and saying, it's 9 o'clock. Everybody's going to bed. Have a good night. So it begins in a very normal way and ends in a very normal way. And throughout the three acts, we just kind of see the different elements of life for these people in New Hampshire.
I know it's got kind of a underlying message about like time and eternity mm-hmm. in it, and how the only eternal thing is like ordinary events.
Right.
What do you think the message of this play is?
I think the message of this play, like I said in the third act, the young woman who this play kind of centers around, Emily Webb, she gets to go back. She asks the narrator, who's kind of serves as the liaison to the audience, but also interacts with the characters on stage. She asks him if she can go back. And she goes back and sees a time in her life. It was her 13th birthday, I believe. She ends up not being able to handle it. She ends up saying, no, I want out. This is too much. This is too hard. So I think, much like you said, I think the theme and the point of this play is to not take every day for granted, to realize that what you have right now is all you've got here on this earth. You know, we see scenes of the milkman delivering milk. Nothing exciting happens. The milkman comes in, delivers milk, makes small talk, and leaves. And I think what Thornton Wilder wanted to do in this and why it's considered such a great piece of literature is that it examines that and just shows it. There's no big scandal other than a drunk organist at the church. It's a normal everyday life. So yeah, like you said, I think he wanted to get across that don't take every day for granted. Every day is a gift, and the normal things are what are extraordinary.
Rose Kristen Presson spoke with Mike Murphy, producer and actor in the Paris Players production of Our Town. The final show is this afternoon at 3 at the Kreider Performing Arts Center in Paris, Tennessee. You can find information about tickets and showtimes at WKMS.org.
On Saturday, September 15th, the Murray State History Department hosts its 11th annual Dr. James W. Hammock Jr. Memorial Scholarship Banquet. And this year's speaker is author, historian, teacher, and MSU alum Barry Craig. The focus of Craig's presentation is, appropriately enough for this election year, the stories contained in his book True Tales of Old-Time Kentucky Politics, Bombast, Bourbon, and Burgoo. And he joins us in the studio to talk about that presentation. Mr. Craig, thanks for stopping by.
Thank you very much. And let me begin by correcting you. It's pronounced Burgoo.
Burgoo.
Burgoo is the fancy way to say it. Now, if you're really down home Kentucky, it's Burgoo.
Were you familiar with Dr. Hammock?
Yes. I had two classes under Jim Hammock at Murray State a number of years ago. I had him for Colonial America. But the more memorable course was History of Kentucky. And Dr. Hammock began his course the same way I begin mine, with wondrous tales of this wondrous place called Kentucky. My favorite tale that he had, and I still use it, is about this minister of the gospel who was trying to describe heaven to his flock. And he simply said, "Heaven is a Kentucky kind of place." I'm not so sure people would say that today, but who knows?
Can you give us a preview of what you'll be talking about at the banquet?
It comes from my book, and I have been collecting Kentucky political stories for many, many years. They're wonderful stories told by extremely gifted orators. Kentucky is famous for oratory. Henry Clay, of course, was one of the greatest political speakers ever. Alvin Barkley wasn't too bad, but they all were. You had to be in the old days. You had to be very talented, and these men lived by their wits, or they died by their wits, and that's what politics was about. Another thing about old-time politics that I despair that's been lost, it really wasn't personal in most cases. You could be a rock-ribbed Republican and a devout Democrat and actually still be friends. That these fellows would tear each other up on the stump. And then afterwards, they'd go have a drink and have a meal. It wasn't personal. And I really am sorry to see that politics today has got a real edge to it. It's really mean-spirited, the hateful things that are said about candidates. And I can just imagine what Dwight Eisenhower would have thought of this. It's sad. And to me, that there's no place in politics for this. This is ridiculous. These ad hominem attacks, this nastiness, I don't like that. And so you study the old-time politics. As I said, it was good-natured. They would tell jokes on one another, and it was not personal. They were true to their beliefs, but it wasn't personal.
Quite a few of the presidential candidates and their surrogates have taken the occasion to refer back to people and events in American history. And sometimes they get it right, and sometimes they completely miss it. So how do we tell the difference between good history and bad history?
Well, I wouldn't take it from a politician. I wouldn't take it from the internet. Call your local college history department and ask them what they would recommend. That's tough. And then, in all fairness, history is interpretation. I try to stress to my students, you know, I suppose in any math class, 2 and 2 is always 4. Mm-hmm. Well, history is interpretation. Hopefully, it's good interpretation. Hopefully, it's interpretation based on evidence. But it is interpretation. And that's what makes history fascinating. And going back to the history department when I was there, there were a whole range of political opinions. Jim Hammock was a rock-ribbed Republican, but I'll tell you this. He never, ever was rude or ugly to others. And that department, I mean, most of them were Democrats. I'm a Democrat of the liberal variety, as were most of the professors. But Jim Hammock was a gentleman in every sense of the word. He never let politics stand in the way of friendship. And I think that's tremendous. He was the consummate gentleman.
Well, having read his book on the War of 1812,
yes.
He certainly never stood in the way of a scholarship.
He was an outstanding scholar, and I treasure a copy of that book that he autographed for me way back when. And I remember when he was writing that book, I was a grad assistant at Murray many years ago, back when I was thin and had hair. That's so long ago I can't remember. Hair on my head, anyway. And he had these letters, these wonderful handwritten letters from the period, various figures in the War of 1812. And the penmanship was pretty bad. And what's interesting is he would read these letters and he would try to decipher them. Then he would hand them to me and say, "What can you make out of them?" And it was really fun trying to puzzle out what these letters said. And back in those days, waste not, want not, they would write on one side of the paper, turn it over and write on the other side of the paper, and it would bleed through.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember doing that, how much fun that was. He was an excellent lecturer. And, of course, that was his specialty, the War of 1812.
Well, let me ask about the significance of history as we enter a fairly transitional period in our modern America, the selection of a new president. What role should history play as we choose another leader?
I think the most objective histories of presidential elections will come many, many years later. It's too early to determine how great a president will be or how this will turn out. So I'd want to give that some time, 10, 15, 20 years before. Now, I think some reporters, want to go back and try to compare elections. And that's kind of a fun thing to do, various elections, the first or the last or whatever. And that always it's fun to put elections in historical context. And that's not to say that we haven't had mudslinging before in vicious elections and things. And I tell my students, would you elect a man for president who is going to close all the churches and burn all the Bibles and have the kids chant mockeries against God? Well, that was Thomas Jefferson. That's what the Federalists said about it. Going to bring the guillotine to America. Call him a Jacobin. Today, I guess the bad word in politics is the L word, liberal. Well, back then it was Jacobin. Jefferson the Jacobin, this crazy fellow who's going to bring the guillotine, the French National Razor, going to start cutting off the heads of true Americans, meaning Federalists, of course. So we've always had that. The mudsling's been part of it. But again, I go back to what I said. It's the edge to it.
Hmm. Most of your work is about Kentucky and Western Kentucky. Why is local and regional history important? And what do you tell people when or if they ask why it matters?
I think one thing, Dr. Thomas D. Clark, who taught history at the University of Kentucky for four or five centuries at least, I guess, he said that it was a great pity that professional historians tended to overlook local history. They considered it to be beneath them or something anyway. They just didn't do much in local history. You can really put it in context. I try to do that. It's also amazing that, for example, Paducah, your hometown. Well, that's the hometown of John T. Scopes of the Tennessee Monkey Trial. Tip O'Neill said all politics is local, all history is too. And I think if you're doing local history, and I always try to put this in a national context, how is Western Kentucky alike or different than the rest of the country? How do these great events affect this part of the world? But again, I wish more historians would get involved in it.
I seem to recall a historian from Southeastern State University who said that local historians seek an intimate connection to place.
Sounds very Wendell Berry-ish, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. But I like that because it seems as though people in this mobile society tend to take for granted where they are. And the more you can dig into that local history, the more that may change.
I like to say that regardless of where you live or what organization you belong to, knowing the history, you're absolutely right, gives you a real connection to it. And I stress to students, you know, you don't have to be a history major to appreciate history. But, well, for example, this is kind of off the wall, I suppose, but I've always thought walking around a college campus, Murray State, for example, Rather Hall, who was Rather? New Richmond. Who was Old Richmond? Who are the Hart Hall? Who was Hart? And that's local history. It's your entry point, if you will, into history.
Hmm.
Because, believe it or not, Paducah, where I work, and Murray, who went to school, and Mayfield, where I live, actually is part of the world.
Author and educator Barry Craig is the featured speaker at this year's James Hammock Memorial Scholarship Banquet. And you can find more information about reservations for the banquet at WKMS.org. Mr. Craig, thanks for speaking with us.
Enjoyed it. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Front Page Sunday from WKMS News. Our correspondents are Drew Adams, Shelley Baskin, Angela Hatton, Casey Northcutt, and Rose Kristen Presson. Kate Lochte is a contributing producer, and Matt Mark Graff provides website assistance.
you have comments or questions about the stories you've heard today, you can email us at msu.wkmsnews@murraystate.edu. You can also have your say on our Facebook page, and there's a link to that at our website, wkms.org, where you can also hear any of today's features again. Thanks for listening.